Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for October 13th, 2017. This is Rachmaninoff's Second Symphony, as it was performed last weekend by the Boston Symphony Orchestra and music director Andras Nelsons. And you can hear this performance again this coming Monday night on WCRB at 8 p.m. during our encore broadcast of the BSO. That program also includes Arlene Sierra's Molaire and Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto with soloist Gil Shaham. And for a preview with Gil, check out last week's episode of The Answered Question. Last weekend also featured a really fascinating broadcast of the Boston Chamber Music Society on WCRB in concert. It begins with music by Brahms, followed by the piano quartet by Mahler, the composer's only known piece of chamber music, and the string sextet by Erich Wolfgang Korngold, the composer who became a Hollywood legend by writing the scores for films like Captain Blood and The Adventures of Robin Hood. You can hear the entire broadcast on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. It's also where you'll find a link to the Boston Chamber Music Society and information about their October 22nd concert at Sanders Theater. On the podcast this week, it's another of the truly great violinists of our time, Hilary Hahn, who's playing with the Boston Symphony this weekend in Dvorak's Violin Concerto. It's part of a program led by Gustavo Gimeno that also includes Ligeti's Romanian Concerto and Schumann's Spring Symphony, and we'll bring it to you live on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. Also on the podcast is David Stern, who's leading Boston Lyric Opera in Puccini's Tosca. He got together with Chris Voss to talk through some pretty unusual twists to that production. Well, earlier this week, I was talking with one of my colleagues at the station, and we ended up talking about one particular weekend from last summer's Tanglewood season, when three of today's top violinists played with the BSO on three consecutive concerts all in that one weekend. And it sort of feels like deja vu at Symphony Hall right now. Last week, it was Gil Shaham. This week, it's Hilary Hahn. She's an incredible violinist who has a track record of going beyond the traditional job description of her occupation, cooking up all kinds of unexpected collaborations every couple of years or so. We talked about some of that, along with a project called In 27 Pieces, in which she commissioned new encores from 27 different composers. We also talked about a particular connection she has to Joseph Silverstein. He was the legendary concertmaster of the BSO for over 20 years. But when I met her before a rehearsal at Symphony Hall this week, I asked Hilary Hahn about the piece she's playing with the BSO, Dvorak's Violin Concerto, and specifically what sets it apart from other violin concertos.
This concerto is kind of irregularly structured in that it has elements of folk music in it. It has very rhapsodic, cadenza-like sort of passages for the violin. It has sort of the traditional three movements for a concerto, so kind of medium exciting for the first movement, and then slow lyrical for the second, and almost like a rondo format for the third. And in that sense, it is a little bit classical. You know, there are many classical concertos that use that rondo format in the final movement. But he does it really, he does the whole piece in his own way. And it's very clearly Dvorak's soundscape. And I really love it because there are so many beautiful moments between the violin and various orchestra members. The different instruments that are brought out, the counter rhythms that occur, and just the passing back and forth of certain thematic melodies is really, really satisfying.
And you're doing it with several orchestras this season, and so you have that chance of collaboration with lots of different musicians, and I imagine that kind of changes from one place to the next, perhaps.
I was just in London, so I'm trying, you know, close comparisons across the pond, I guess. But in a way, I bring similar ideas to each week because I know what I'm starting with, but a lot of it adjusts in the rehearsal process. And it might have something to do with the conductor's take on it, but often for me, the things that adjust the most are in reaction to how the orchestra naturally plays. There are a lot of things we don't have time to micromanage in rehearsal, and these orchestras, they're great, and they have their own styles, and there's no reason to change that. So it's just a matter of finding common ground so that we can have a great mutual interpretation.
So I've looked at your career for years, as a lot of people have, and I just love these projects that seem to come out of nowhere, like the collaboration with Hauschka and the 27 Encore project and recording and Josh Ritter, all these things that you've done. And it makes me wonder, when I look at those all together, or even some of them together, does one of those projects that you take on from time to time organically lead you to a new idea? Or do you sort of close the chapter on each one of these and then think of something brand new to kind of occupy your mind after that?
The common thread is the typical, concerto, recital, chamber kinds of performances. And I do, by far, if you're comparing genres of music that I play, it's by far dominantly classical music. But in order to better understand the creative process, the thing that really inspires me is the creative process. How are composers thinking? And you can't necessarily ask the former composers who aren't with us anymore. And you can't necessarily get that information from their biography or from their letters, because people don't share what's in their head in every single context. So while it is helpful to have background, it's also helpful for me, also from my own creative process, to interact with people who are making things in the moment and see, what does that feel like for them? Can I shift my perspective by being with them in that process? And I think that's been the generator for almost all of the projects. In a sense, the projects have been linear. If you look at them in a batch or you isolate them, it may not be clear what the linear element is, but for example, my first non-classical thing I did was a track on, there's a band called And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. So I did a track, a violin solo with band accompaniment, but no vocals, for one of their albums, and they'd asked me to do it. So the melody was basically written out already. So it wasn't really improvising, but I got a chance to work with one of the band members who'd written the melody to embellish it and make it a little bit more violin exploitive. So that was kind of the first step. And then after that, I had a friend who I thought I would maybe do the same thing. I would write a little violin part for one of his songs. It was Josh Ritter. And it wasn't that I wanted to be on a recording of his or anything. I just thought it would be fun to maybe play in one of his shows sometime. So I said, we were having lunch somewhere in Canada. And I said, if you ever need a violinist, let me know. And he said, how would you like to play on my show tomorrow? So I said, yeah, sure. That sounds great. Uh-huh. I went back to the hotel and I wrote up a little violin part that I thought would work great with the song that he was going to do. I had it all memorized. I was ready. And then the half hour before the performance, I said, can we run it through? And he said, sure. And he pulled out his capo. It was a different key. And I wasn't good at transposing, so I couldn't remember it anymore. And I got on stage, my knees were knocking, and I just made something up, and I played really quietly when I wasn't sure I was in the right chord. And that was my first improvisation experience. So from there, it's just kind of things like that. One thing leads to another. With the encores, it was noticing another pattern is I notice a gap in the repertoire or in my repertoire, and if I don't see it being filled by someone else, I realized this is something that would be helpful for the grand scheme if someone did this, and then that stuff is there for other people later. So that was the case with the contemporary commissioned encores.
Okay, I'm going to put the interview on hold here to give you a more tangible sense of In 27 Pieces, which Hillary released on two CDs a few years ago. There's an incredible range of music on the recording, from really beautiful, sweet music by the late Aino Juhani Rautavaara, and Valentin Silvestrov. Two pieces that are made for more of a pop, like the ones from Paul Moravec. and Avner Dorman. Very cool stuff. I think you'll want to check out the entire collection in 27 pieces. Okay, back to the interview.
And I can't imagine you didn't get most of those encores, if not all of them, and think, oh my gosh, this is so great that I want this person to do more, and it must have sparked all kinds of ideas for further commissions.
Absolutely. At the same time, I was just trying to keep my head above the water.
It's a lot.
Because I didn't realize, I thought of it in terms of minutes. I'd never done multiple commissions at the same time, and I'd only done concerto commissions. So I was thinking, well, this adds up to however many minutes, like maybe three concertos worth of music, and I kind of know what it is to prepare that. But I hadn't thought about the fact that since I hadn't played most of these composers' work before, it was not just the number of minutes, but it was also getting into their style, their implications in their writing, and also just understanding when they write this, they mean this. Because sometimes composers would write the same word in their scores, then I go for a coaching, and I realize they meant opposite things. So really trying to get into these particular pieces, create interpretations that fit those pieces, and get that music really deeply ingrained was a whole other experience than what I expected. And it was really, really educational for me and really helpful in all my other work.
I just think artistically it's one of the most fabulous things anybody has done, because it just gives you this snapshot of so many voices, and there's so many great pieces. Really, all of them, like I said, but there are some that really stand out. Anyway.
That was my goal. Thank you.
good. You succeeded. I was walking into the hall today, and one of the folks here on the BSO staff mentioned that you had played at the memorial for Joseph Silverstein.
I did.
Yeah. Did you know him? And
yes.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
I met him when I was very young. I think I was it like 11 or 12? No, maybe I was 13, but somewhere in there, early teen years. And I was introduced to him. I played a little bit for him, and he kind of gave me a bit of a coaching. And I remember that he said, I remember this one thing he told me, because it jumped out so much and I didn't entirely understand it. And now I understand it and it's still true. But he encouraged me to play closer to the bridge. And he said, because, you know, that's the high rent district. And I was like, what is a high rent district? What does that even mean? But the word stuck in my head, and someone explained that, oh, that must mean blah, blah, blah. But now, because that was a quote that was kind of mysterious to me and like very memorable, I actually apply it. I do play closer to the bridge, probably largely because of what he said to me, which is a large part of my tone production. So you never know what's going to influence you. But right. I worked with him then he conducted me in Salt Lake City in a New Year's concert, and it was the first time I was officially up past midnight. I had a great time. And I worked with him in chamber music at Lincoln Center. And I kept seeing him on and off in passing, like if I would play at Tanglewood, or he taught at Curtis after a while. So then I would see him every now and then at Curtis. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that I saw him all the time, but for me, he was a very important figure. When I was growing up, we had some LPs, and one of them was The Four Seasons with the Boston Symphony, and it was such a classic recording for me. I also loved the cover. It was beautiful cover art.
Yeah, it was a great
art.
Cover, right.
So it really, like, that whole record for me is, a very memorable one.
Yeah. Hilary Hahn, thanks so much for taking some time to talk with me today.
Thank you.
You can hear Hilary Hahn's Dvorak Violin Concerto performance live on Saturday during our Boston Symphony Orchestra broadcast, which begins at 8 p.m. This weekend, Boston Lyric Opera is opening a new production of Puccini's Tosca. It's a production with a pretty unusual twist, mostly due to where it's being performed, at the Cutler Majestic Theater. So Chris Voss got together to talk about it with the conductor, David Stern. Here's their conversation.
Puccini's Tosca is such a big work that is a favorite. It's a good thing to put on in opera houses because people love it and people come, and it's great music. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you first came to Puccini's Tosca.
Well, let's just talk about, first of all, Puccini, period. Puccini is the most maligned favorite composer in the world because everyone adores Puccini operas. He's always number one hit for opera house programs. And yet, as an important composer in music history, he's always denigrated. He's always put down as someone who wrote just beautiful melodies and lush orchestrations and, yeah, great operas, but so what? And it's such a shame because this composer is so important and integral to the development of music theater. Now, Puccini grew up in a very poor family and did not have enough money to have the education that he felt he should have to become a great composer. And this was always a problem for him. And he felt like the Germans had it over him in terms of culture, education, understanding, psychology. And so he almost downgraded his own understanding of music and interpretation. His writing is as subtle and as brilliant as anything that Strauss ever wrote. And even though he doesn't have this cult following that Wagner does, his music is as important. And Tosca is extreme Puccini. Now, what does that mean? It means that when we're talking about Puccini in terms of his own writing, we have to remember he really is part of the Verismo period. And too often he's put into a romantic context. And the romantic context allows us to say, oh, beautiful, lush melodies. It's not just beautiful, lush melodies.
Yeah, it's about realism in the story.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And in, you know, here we have a manic, authoritarian figure who uses a bullying tactic on the woman in a misogynistic way in order to get her to do what he wants and to press sexual favors from her. How modern is that? But today, in looking at Puccini, when people say, oh, how can Puccini be important and relevant to today's society? It is today's society. It's like saying, how can Shakespeare be relevant? Well, if we don't learn about Shakespeare, then we don't learn about ourselves. And I would say the same thing about Puccini and Tosca more than all.
As a singer and as an audience member with Puccini, one of the things that I've always loved is the music seems like conversation. And in that, it is extremely difficult, I found as a singer, to pull off. What is that difficulty for you as a conductor to put together a show that feels real and yet is staying to the script that is right in front of you?
Yeah, you have good questions. So Puccini's writing is so meticulous that if you do the fluctuations of tempo that are indicated in the score and you really try to follow them. Now, if you follow them, that doesn't mean you don't have any leeway. You are expected to have leeway as an interpreter, and every great composer knows that. But if you follow what he's indicating, then it sounds like everything is in tempo. That's what's amazing. Even though there are not three measures in the same tempo in the entire piece, you're constantly fluctuating. But if you do it in the way where it is honest to the text, then the audience doesn't perceive that there are changes. When someone comes up to me and says, oh, my God, this piece, oh, my God, it's amazing. He goes back and forth and the tempi change all the time. And if that person says that, then I've not done my job. When the person comes in and says, oh, my God, everything sounds fluid. And meanwhile, everything, of course, is, you know, changing constantly. That's when we've done our job, because it's that fluidity that you're looking for. And it's all written in the score. It's so beautiful. And the problem is that there are wonderful singers who sing the heck out of Puccini these days. But as soon as a singer becomes sentimental with Puccini, as soon as that singer indulges too much in the moment and it becomes about that singer, then we lose the story, we lose the text, we lose the moment, and we come out of the story. And we say, okay, well, yes, we were into the realism, but now we're just going to listen to the beautiful singing and then we'll get back to the story. Then we've lost Puccini. Puccini never really gives in to lackadaisical or self-absorbed interpretation. You have to keep with the text. Stay on text.
The production at the Cutler Majestic is interesting in the way that it's being staged because, and for people listening, the Cult and Majestic has a very small pit, and Puccini's orchestra calls for a very big orchestra, which is sort of a problem. So
yes.
The BLO has come up with a solution. What is the solution?
Well, they call it integrating the orchestra into the action. So actually, we are posed on top of the set, 10 feet up, behind the singers, towards the back of the stage, which means that the singers will see me only on monitors, and I will be close to the scrim. There'll be a scrim between the orchestra and the rest of the stage. I should be able to hear them through the scrim, and also I will have a monitor reflecting their sound back to me. But they will be dependent on following me on a screen, and that makes everything a little bit dicey. So how do we overcome that? Well, I've been here now for 3 weeks rehearsing with Crystal Manich and the singers and doing the production, and meticulously we are trying to cover every little corner where ambiguity would otherwise happen in a normal situation, where if I'm in the pit, I can see that they're going to take time, or I can see physically when they're going to start singing at a moment where I have to follow. I won't be able to see them. So we have to work things out, which means that we need to have a relationship, a very tight relationship. And that's very luckily what's been happening. I've been enjoying this cast tremendously.
I imagine that sort of a flipping the script, as it were, on a production can be very exciting for an artist to do something a little bit different like this.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I've done operas where I've been behind and diagonally on the side of the stage behind the singers, but on the same level. This is the first time where I will be 10 feet above and not necessarily being able to see that there are human beings on the stage at the right time. I mean, should someone somehow, you know, trip, happens, or just miss their cue to come in, I may not know that. So I have to make sure that I have some kind of visual upon, yeah. There are moments that it'll be interesting.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting. But it does mean that you make a list of the priorities. What tempo are you going to take here? What is the relationship? How are we going to get from this section to the next? And it's actually forced me to ask questions of myself, of the way I've done it last time, and how I can make sure that this is smoother. And so I've enjoyed that process very much.
I want to gear shift a little bit about you as a conductor, because you do a lot of work that people in Boston will know a fair amount about, and that is early music ensembles, or at least period instrument ensembles, coming up, doing work with Concerto Cologne, with John Elliott Gardner, and then your opera Fuoco. You guys do period instrument.
Only period instrument.
What is different about approaching an opera that uses those gut-stringed, lower-tuned orchestral instruments?
Not necessarily lower-tuned. I mean, in Monteverdi we do in 440.
Oh, do you?
And, you know, they're... Yeah. The A was all over the place in those days. So we do have kind of artificial levels, the norms that we use today, but we do have to accept that they're pretty artificial.
But it's still, the approach must be very different than a big orchestra like the Puccini Orchestra.
Completely different. And yet, because I've worked so long with period instruments in opera repertoire, what advantage these instrumentalists have is that with these old bows, especially the bows, the gut strings, the whole different setup, the winds, natural winds and brass, they are much more attuned to rhetoric.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in the 18th century, every musician had to study rhetoric as well. In other words, certain phrases of speech, how to carry certain gestures. The whole idea that music is not just notes, but an actual gesture was formalized in the 18th century, 17th century and 18th century. And the idea that a music, if you're playing a gavotte, for example, where the rhythm would be tum, tum, bum, ya-ta-ta-ta-tum, that upbeat is not just 2/8 notes. It's a gesture, bum, bum, bum. And as soon as you talk about a gavotte gesture, then the musician knew how to play the gavotte. It wasn't, oh, this is an 8th note and this is... And we don't talk often in rehearsal, we don't talk about 8th notes and quarter notes. We don't talk about 14 piano. I'll say something like, this is galant, or this is more rococo, or this is This is buffo, and they'll change their playing simply because of the genre or the gesture. And that way of playing supports accompanying a voice in a different way. What I've learned over the years is that using very similar vocabulary, I can often ask a modern orchestra to do that. And once we have a good enough relationship, it works. You have to court that relationship. You have to court that way of expressing something. So it's not just a question of louder, softer, faster, slower. There is much more than that. And that nuance is something that I enjoy very much with Opera Foco that I work with in Paris. And every time we work with our singers, the orchestra insists on knowing what the text is. And they'll say, if there's a word that somebody doesn't understand, they'll say, okay, well, what is that word? Because I have to know how to play for that word. And that's a question that is beautiful. I love that question. And that whole relationship between the orchestra and the stage then becomes very, very vibrant. And I try to bring that out when I do modern repertoire as well, because I think if you're doing Tosca or if you're doing Wozzeck, you have to have that same attitude, that same approach. And then what's going on in the pit is all the more intensive.
I wonder if you can point to a moment in the Tosca score where you really try to use that sort of approach with here with the Boston Lyric.
At the very beginning of the third act, the shepherd, actually in our case a shepherdess, because it's a young soprano who's singing, she sings a berceuse. A berceuse is a lullaby, and a lullaby has a certain gesture to it. And it's a berceuse. You have to sing it as if you have a child in your arms and you're cradling the child. There's no, whether it's 18th century, 19th century, 20th or 21st century, a berceuse is a berceuse. And you have to find, of course, it changes depending on the period, how that rocking feeling comes through. But in Tosca, when you have this kind of genre, you have to realize what you're doing with it. And it's beautiful to look at it that way. Vici d'arte is not an aria in this sense. Vici d'arte is a prayer. And it goes from a prayer to recitative. And that fine relationship between the spoken and the sung is what makes that moment so human and fragile. Because that's what's amazing about Tosca. She's always showing her actress's side. She's at coming in and having a huge fit in the first act, and she's demanding that the painting the tenor is working on have black eyes, and because God forbid, you know, it should be anyone else's eyes but hers. So she has all these whimsical sides. And then in Vici d'arte, finally, she just shows herself. And when you just show yourself, then it's not about the voice. It's about everything that Tosca's gone through. And for me, to get to that point, it's how the soprano manages to juggle between that spoken moment, which sings about sorrows that you cannot explain in words, and then these words, which illuminate a fragile side and a fear that she doesn't know how to reckon with. And that's what makes that aria special to me.
David Stern, thank you so much for taking a moment to come by WCRB and to chat with me about Tosca. Tosca runs October 13th through the 22nd over at Emerson's Cutler Majestic Theater. Very much looking forward to it. And thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
That's my colleague Chris Voss with David Stern. And you can find more info about Boston Lyric Opera's Tosca at our website, classicalwcrb.org. You can subscribe to The Answered Question at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. TAQ is also on SoundCloud and at that website, classicalwcrb.org. Thank you to Hilary Hahn and David Stern, as well as the staffs of the BSO and the BLO, and my colleague Chris Voss. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.